wipe away her tears. I watch her walk away. I shut my door, expecting to feel even the slightest ripple of relief over the fact that I was able to let her walk away. Instead, I'm met with the only familiar sensation my heart is capable of feeling. Pain. "You're a goddamn idiot," Ian says from behind me. I turn around and he's sitting on the arm of the couch staring at me. "Why are you not going after her right now?" "Because, Ian, I hate this feeling. I hate every feeling she evokes in me because it fills me with all the things I spent the last 6 years avoiding." "Why would I do that?" I ask as I head toward my room. I pause with the knock at my front door. I expel a frustrated breath before turning back to the door, not wanting to have to turn her away for a second time. I will, though. Even if I have to lay it out in terms that will hurt her even more, she needs to accept the fact that it's over. I let it go too far. Hell, I never should have allowed it to begin, with us knowing it would more than likely end this way. I open the door but find Corbin in my line of sight rather than Tate. I want to feel relieved by the fact that it's him standing here rather than her, but the fuming look on his face makes it impossible to feel relieved. Before I can react, his fist connects with my mouth, and I stumble backward toward the couch. Ian breaks my fall, and I steady myself before turning to face the door again. "What the hell, Corbin?" Ian yells. He's holding me back, assuming I want retaliation. I don't. I deserved that. Corbin trades looks between the two of us, finally settling on me. He pulls his fist up to his chest and rubs it with his other hand. "We all know I should have done that a long time ago." He grips the doorknob and pulls the door shut, disappearing back out into the hallway. I shrug out of Ian's grasp and bring my hand up to my lip. I pull my fingers back. They're tinged with blood. "How about now?" Ian says, hopeful. "You gonna go after her now?" I glare at him before turning to stalk off to my bedroom. Ian laughs loudly. It's the kind of laugh that says, "You're a goddamn idiot." Only he already said that, so he's kind of just repeating himself. He follows me to my bedroom. I'm not really in the mood for this conversation. Good thing I know how to look at people without actually seeing them. I take a seat on my bed, and he walks into my room and leans against the door. "I'm tired of this, Miles. 6 fucking years I've watched this zombie walk around in your place." "I'm not a zombie," I say flatly. "Zombies can't fly." Ian rolls his eyes, obviously not in the mood for jokes. Good thing, because I'm not really in the mood to make them. He continues to glare at me, so I pick up my phone and lie back on the bed in order to pretend he isn't here. "She's the first thing to breathe life back into you since the night you drowned in that fucking lake." "I'll hurt him. If he doesn't leave right this second, I'll fucking hurt him." "Get out."
"No."
I look at him. I see him. "Get the hell out, Ian." He walks to my desk, pulls out the chair, and sits in it.
"Fuck you, Miles," he says. "I'm not finished."
"Get out."
"No."
I stop fighting him. I get up and walk out myself. He follows me. "Let me ask you one question," he says, trailing me into the living room. "And then you'll get out?" He nods. "And then I'll get out."
"Fine."
He regards me silently for a few moments. I patiently wait for his question so he can leave before I hurt him.
"What if someone told you they could erase that entire night from your memory, but in doing so, they also have to erase every single good thing? All the moments with Rachel, every word, every kiss, every I love you. Every moment you had with your son, no matter how brief. The first moment you saw Rachel holding him, the first moment you held him, the first time you heard him cry or watched him sleep, all of it, gone. Forever. If someone told you they could get rid of the ugly stuff, but you'd lose all the other stuff too, would you do it?"
He thinks he's asking me something I've never asked myself before. Does he think I don't sit and wonder about this stuff every fucking day of my life? "You didn't say I had to answer your question. You just asked if you could ask it. You can leave now." I'm the worst kind of person.
"You can't answer it," he says. "You can't say yes."
"I also can't say no," I tell him. "Congratulations, Ian. You've stumped me. Goodbye." I begin to walk back to my room, but he says my name again.
I stop and put my hands on my hips and drop my head. Why won't he stop with it already? It's been 6 damn years. He should know that night made me who I am now. He should know I'm not changing. If I would have asked you that a few months ago, you would have said yes before the question even left my mouth, he says. Your answer has always been yes. You would have given up anything to not have to relive that night. I turn around and he's heading toward the door. He opens it, then pauses and faces me again. If being with Tate for a few short months can make that pain bearable enough for you to answer with a maybe, imagine what a lifetime with her could do for you. He closes the door. I close my eyes. Something happens. Something inside me. It's as if his words have created an avalanche out of the glacier surrounding my heart. I feel chunks of hardened ice break off and fall next to all the other pieces that have detached since the moment I met Tate. I step off the elevator and walk over to the empty chair next to Cap. He doesn't even acknowledge my presence with eye contact. He's staring across the lobby toward the exit. You just let her go, he says, not even attempting to hide the disappointment in his voice. I don't respond. He pushes on the arms of his chair with his hands, repositioning himself. Some people, they grow wiser as they grow older. Unfortunately, most people just grow older. He turns to face me. You're one of the ones just been growing older, because you are as stupid as you were the day you were born. Cap knows me well enough to know this is what had to happen. He's known me all my life, having worked maintenance on my father's apartment building since before I was born. Before that, he worked for my grandfather, doing the same thing. This pretty much guarantees he knows more about me and my family than even I do. It had to happen, Cap, I say, excusing the fact that I let the only girl who has been able to reach me in more than 6 years just walk away. Had to happen, huh? He grumbles. As long as I've known him, and as many nights as I've spent down here talking to him, he's never once given me an opinion about the decisions I've made for myself. He knows the life I chose after Rachel. He spouts off tidbits of wisdom here and there, but never his opinion. He's listened to me vent about the situation with Tate for months, and he always sits quietly, patiently hearing me out, never giving me advice. That's what I like about him. I feel that's all about to change. Before you give me a lecture, Cap, I say, interrupting him before he has the chance to continue. You know she's better off. I turn and face him. You know she is. Cap chuckles, nodding his head. That's for damn sure. I look at him disbelievingly. Did he just agree with me? Are you saying I made the right choice? He's quiet for a second before blowing out a quick breath. His expression contorts as if his thoughts aren't something he necessarily wants to share. He relaxes into his chair and folds his arms loosely over his chest. I told myself to never get involved in your problems, boy, because in order for a man to give advice, he better know what the hell he's talking about. And Lord knows, in all my 80 years, I ain't never been through nothing like what you went through. I don't know the first thing about what that was like or what that did to you. Just thinking about that night makes my gut hurt, so I know you feel it in your gut, too. And your heart. And your bones. And your soul. I close my eyes, wishing I could close my ears. Instead, I don't want to hear this. None of the people in your life knows what it feels like to be you. Not me. Not your father. Not those friends of yours. Not even Tate. There's only one person who feels what you feel. Only one person who hurts like you hurt. Only one other parent to that baby boy who misses him the same way you do. My eyes are closed tightly now, and I'm doing all I can to respect his end of the conversation, but it's taking all I have not to get up and walk away. He has no right bringing Rachel into this conversation. Miles, he says quietly, there's determination in his voice like he needs me to take him seriously. I always do. You believed you took away that girl's chance at happiness, and until you confront that past, you won't ever move forward. You're going to be reliving that day every single day until the day you die, unless you go see for your own eyes that she's okay. Maybe then you'll see it's okay for you to be happy, too. I lean forward and run my hands over my face, then rest my elbows on my knees and look down. I watch as a single tear falls from my eye and drops to the floor beneath my feet. "And what happens if she's not okay?" I whisper. Cap leans forward and clasps his hands between his knees. I turn and look at him, seeing tears in his eyes for the first time in the 24 years I've known him.
"Then I guess nothing changes. You can keep on feeling like you don't deserve a life for ruining hers. You can keep on avoiding everything that might make you feel again."
He leans in toward me and lowers his voice.
"I know the thought of confronting your past terrifies you. It terrifies every man. But sometimes we don't do it for ourselves. We do it for the people we love more than ourselves."
Chapter 37. Rachel. "Brad," I yell. "Someone's at the door." I grab a dish towel and dry my hands. "Got it," he says, passing through the kitchen. I take a quick inventory of the kitchen to make sure there isn't anything my mother can insult. Counters are clean, floors are clean. "Bring it on, Mom."
"Wait here,"
Brad says to whoever is at the door. "Wait here? Brad wouldn't say that to my mother."
"Rachel,"
Brad says from the kitchen entryway. I turn around to face him, and I immediately tense. The look on his face is one I rarely ever see. It's reserved for preparation. When he's about to tell me something I don't want to hear, or something he's afraid will hurt me, my immediate thoughts fall to my mother, and I'm gripped with worry. "Brad," I whisper, "what is it?" I'm holding the counter next to me. The familiar fear washes over me that used to live and breathe inside me. But now it's something that only grips me on occasion. Like right now, when my husband is too afraid to tell me something he's not sure I want to hear.
"Someone's here to see you," he says.
I don't know of anyone who could make Brad as concerned as he is right now. "Who?" He slowly walks toward me and cups my face in his hands when he reaches me. He looks into my eyes as if he's trying to brace me for a fall.
"It's Miles."
I don't move. I don't fall, but Brad holds me up anyway. He wraps his arms around me and pulls me against his chest. "Why is he here?" My voice trembles. Brad shakes his head.
"I don't know."
He pulls away and looks down on me.
"I'll ask him to leave if you need me to."
I immediately shake my head. I wouldn't do that to him. Not if he came all the way to Phoenix. Not after almost 7 years.
"Do you need a few minutes? I can take him to the living room."
I don't deserve this man. I don't know what I'd do without him. He knows my history with Miles. He knows everything we went through. It took me a while to be able to tell him the whole story. He knows all of this, and he's still standing here, offering to invite the only other man I've ever loved into our home. "I'm okay," I tell him, even though I'm not. I don't know if I want to see Miles. I have no idea why he's here. "Are you okay?" He nods.
"He looks upset. I think you should talk to him."
He leans in and kisses me on the forehead.
"He's in the foyer. I'll be in my office if you need me."
I nod and then I kiss him. I kiss him hard. He walks away, and I'm left standing silently in the kitchen, my heart beating erratically within my chest. I take a deep breath, but it does nothing to calm me. I brush my hands down my shirt and walk toward the foyer. Miles's back is to me, but he hears me round the corner. He turns his head slightly over his shoulder, almost as if he's just as afraid to turn around and look at me as I am to see him. He does it carefully, slowly. Suddenly, my eyes are locked with his. I know it's been 6 years, But in that 6 years, he's somehow completely changed without changing at all. He's still Miles, but he's a man now. This makes me wonder what he's seeing, looking at me for the first time since the day I left him.
"Hey,"
he says, treading carefully. His voice is different. It isn't the voice of a teenager anymore. "Hi." I lose his gaze as his eyes travel around the foyer. He takes in my home, a home I never expected to see him in. We both stand in silence for a whole minute, maybe two.
"Rachel, I..."
He looks back at me again.
"I don't know why I'm here."
I do. I can see it in his eyes. I got to know those eyes so well when we were together. I knew all his thoughts, all his emotions. He wasn't able to hide how he felt because he felt so much. He's always felt so much. He's here because he needs something. I don't know what. Answers, maybe? Closure? I'm glad he waited until now to get it because I think I'm finally ready to give it. "It's good to see you," I tell him. Our voices are weak and timid. It's weird seeing someone for the first time under different circumstances from when you parted. I loved this man. I loved him with all my heart and soul. I loved him like I love Brad. I also hated him. "Come in," I say, motioning toward the living room. "Let's talk." He takes two hesitant steps toward the living room. I turn around and let him follow me. We both take a seat on the sofa. He doesn't get comfortable. Instead, he sits on the edge of it and leans forward, resting his elbows on his knees. He's looking around, taking in my home once more, my life. "You're brave," I say. He looks at me, waiting for me to continue. "I've thought about this, Miles, about seeing you again. I look down. I just couldn't."
"Why not?"
he says almost immediately. I make eye contact with him again. "The same reason you haven't. We don't know what to say." He smiles, but it's not the smile I used to love on Miles. This one is guarded, and I wonder if I did this to him, if I'm responsible for all the sad parts of him. There are so many sad parts of him now. He picks up a photo of Brad and me from the end table. His eyes study the picture in his hands for a moment.
"Do you love him?"
he asks, continuing to stare at the picture.
"Like you loved me?"
He's not asking in a bitter or jealous way. He's asking in a curious way. "Yes," I reply, "just as much." He places the picture back on the end table but continues to stare at it.
"How?"
he whispers.
"How did you do that?"
His words bring tears to my eyes because I know exactly what he's asking me. I asked myself the same question for several years until I met Brad. I didn't think I'd ever be able to love someone again. I didn't think I'd want to love someone again. Why would anyone want to put themselves in a position that could bring back the type of pain that makes a person envious of death? "I want to show you something, Miles." I stand up and reach out for his hand. He watches my hand cautiously for a moment before finally reaching for it. His fingers slide through mine and he squeezes my hand as he stands up. I begin making my way toward the bedroom and he follows closely behind me. We reach the bedroom door and my fingers pause on the doorknob. My heart is heavy. The emotions and everything we went through are surfacing, but I know I have to allow them to surface if I want to help him. I push the door open and walk inside, pulling Miles behind me. As soon as we're inside the room, I feel his fingers tighten around mine.
"Rachel,"
he whispers. His voice is a plea for me not to do this. I feel him try to pull back toward the door, but I don't let him. I make him walk to her crib with me. He's standing by my side, but I can feel him struggling because he doesn't want to be in here right now. He's squeezing my hand so tightly, I can feel the hurt in his heart. He blows out a quick breath as he looks down on her. I see the roll of his throat when he swallows, then blows out another steadying breath. I watch as his free hand comes up and grips the edge of her crib, holding onto it as tightly as the hand that's wrapped around mine.
"What's her name?"
he whispers. "Claire." His whole body reacts with my response. His shoulders immediately begin to shake, and he tries to hold in his breath, but nothing can stop it. Nothing can stop him from feeling what he's feeling, so I just allow him to feel it. He pulls his hand from mine and covers his mouth to conceal the quick rush of air released from his lungs. He turns and walks swiftly out of the room. I follow him just as fast, in time to see his back hit the hallway wall across from her nursery. He slides to the floor, and the tears begin to fall hard. He doesn't try to cover them. He pulls his hands through his hair, and he leans his head back against the wall and looks up at me.
"That's..."
He points to Claire's nursery and tries to speak, but it takes him several tries to get his sentence out.
"That's his sister,"
he finally says, blowing out an unsteady breath.
"Rachel, you gave him a sister."
I sink to the floor next to him and wrap my arm around his shoulders, stroking his hair with my other hand. He presses his palms to his forehead and squeezes his eyes shut, crying quietly to himself. "Miles?" I don't even try to disguise the tears in my voice. "Look at me." He leans his head back against the wall, but he can't look me in the eyes. "I'm sorry I blamed you. You lost him too. I didn't know how else to deal with it back then." My words completely break him, and I'm consumed with guilt over allowing 6 years to pass without letting him hear those words. He leans over and wraps his arms tightly around me, pulling me against him. I let him hold me. He holds me for a long time, until all the apologies and forgiveness are absorbed and it's just us again. No tears. I would be lying if I said I never think about what I did to him. I think about it every day. But I was 18 and devastated, and nothing mattered to me after that night. Nothing. I just wanted to forget. But every morning I woke up and didn't feel Clayton by my side, I blamed Miles. I blamed him for saving me because I had no reason left to live. I also knew in my heart that Miles did what he could. I knew in my heart that it was never his fault, but at that point in my life, I wasn't capable of rational thought or even forgiveness. At that point in my life, I was convinced I wouldn't be capable of anything at all but feeling pain. Those feelings never wavered for more than 3 years, until the day I met Brad. I don't know who Miles has, but the familiar struggle in his eyes proves there's someone. I used to see the same struggle every time I looked in the mirror, unsure if I had it in me to love again. "Do you love her?" I ask him. I don't need to know her name. We're beyond that now. I know he isn't here because he's still in love with me. He's here because he doesn't know how to love at all. He sighs and rests his chin on top of my head.
"I'm scared I won't be able to."
Miles kisses the top of my head and I close my eyes. I listen to his heart beating inside his chest. A heart he's claiming isn't capable of knowing how to love, but in actuality, it's a heart that loves too much. He loved so much, and that one night took it away from us, changed our worlds, changed his heart. "I used to cry all the time," I tell him. "All the time. In the shower, in the car, in my bed. Every time I was alone, I would cry. For those first couple of years, my life was constant sadness, penetrated by nothing, not even good moments." I feel his arms wrap tighter around me, silently telling me he knows. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. Then when I met Brad, I found myself having these brief moments where my life wasn't sad every second of the day. I would go somewhere with him in a car, and I'd realize it was my first time in a car without crying at least one tear. The nights we would spend together were the only nights I wouldn't cry myself to sleep. For the first time, this impenetrable sadness that had become me was being broken by the brief, good moments I spent with Brad. I pause, needing a moment. I haven't had to think about this in a while, and the emotions and feelings are too fresh, too real. I pull away from Miles and lean back against the wall, then rest my head on his shoulder. He tilts his head until it's resting against mine and grabs my hand, intertwining our fingers. After a while, I began to notice that the good moments with Brad began to outweigh all the sadness. The sadness that was my life became the moments, and my happiness with Brad became my life. I feel him exhale, and I know he knows what I'm talking about. I know that whoever she is, he's had those good moments with her. For the entire 9 months I was pregnant with Claire, I was so scared I wouldn't be able to cry from happiness when I saw her. Right after she was born, they handed her to me, just like they did when Clayton was born. Claire looked just like him, Miles. Just like him. I was staring down at her, holding her in my arms, and tears were running down my cheeks. But I was crying good tears, and I realized at that moment that they were the first tears of happiness I had cried since the day I held Clayton in my arms. I wipe my eyes and let go of his hand, then lift my head off his shoulder. "You deserve that too," I tell him. "You deserve to feel that again." He nods.
"I want to love her so much, Rachel,"
he says, breathing out the words like they've been pent up forever.
"I want that with her so much. I'm just scared the rest of it will never go away."
"The pain will never go away, Miles. Ever. But if you let yourself love her, you'll only feel it sometimes, instead of allowing it to consume your entire life." He wraps his arm around me and pulls my forehead against his lips. He kisses me long and hard before pulling back. He nods, letting me know that he understands what I'm trying to explain to him. "You've got this, Miles," I say, repeating the same words he used to comfort me with. "You've got this." He laughs, and it's as if I can feel some of the heaviness lift away from him.
"You know what I was most afraid of tonight?"
he asks.
"I was afraid that when I got here, you'd be just like me."
He brushes my hair back and smiles.
"I'm so happy you're not. It makes me feel good to see you happy."
He pulls me to him and hugs me tightly.
"Thank you, Rachel,"
he whispers. He kisses me gently on the cheek before releasing me to stand up.
"I should probably go now. I have a million things I want to tell her."
He makes his way down the hallway toward the living room, then turns to face me one last time. I no longer see all the sad parts of him. Now I just see a calmness when I look in his eyes.
"Rachel?"
He pauses, watching me quietly for a moment. A peaceful smile slowly spreads across his face.
"I'm so proud of you."
He disappears from the hallway, and I remain on the floor until I hear the front door close behind him. "I'm proud of you too, Miles."
Chapter 38, Tate. I close the door to my car and walk to the stairs leading up to the second floor of my apartment complex. I'm relieved not to have to use the elevator anymore, but I can't help but miss Cap a little bit, even if his advice didn't make a whole lot of sense to me the majority of the time. It was nice just having him there to vent to. I've been keeping myself busy with work and school, trying to stay focused, but it's been hard. I've been in my new apartment for 2 weeks now, and even though I wish I were alone, I never am. Every time I walk in through my front door, Miles is still everywhere. He's still in everything, and I keep waiting until he's not. I keep waiting for the day when it will hurt less, when I won't miss him as much. I would say my heart is broken, but it's not. I don't think it is. Actually, I wouldn't know, because my heart hasn't been in my chest since I left it lying in front of his apartment the day I told him goodbye. I tell myself to take it one day at a time, but it's so much easier said than done, especially when those days turn into nights and I have to lie in my bed alone, listening to the silence. The silence was never so loud until I told Miles goodbye. I'm already dreading opening my apartment door, and I'm not even halfway up the stairwell yet. I can already tell this night isn't going to be any different from all the other nights since Miles. I reach the top of the stairs and turn left toward my apartment, but my feet stop working. My legs stop working. I can feel the thumping of a heart somewhere in my chest again for the first time in 2 weeks. Miles? He doesn't move. He's sitting on the floor in front of my apartment, propped up against the door. I walk slowly toward him, not sure what to make of his appearance. He's not in uniform. He's casually dressed, and the stubble on his face proves he hasn't worked in a few days. There's also what looks like a fresh bruise under his right eye. I'm scared to wake him up, because if he's as belligerent as he was the first time I met him, I don't want to deal with it. But once again, there's no way I can get around him and inside my apartment without waking him up. I look up and inhale a deep breath, wondering what to do. I'm afraid if I wake him up, I'll cave. I'll let him inside, and I'll give him what he's here for, which definitely isn't the part of me I want to give him. "Tate," he says. I look down at him, and he's awake now, pulling himself up, watching me nervously. I take a step back once he's standing because I forgot how tall he is. How much he becomes everything when he's standing right in front of me. "How long have you been here?" I ask him. He glances down to the cell phone in his hand.
6 hours.
He looks back up at me.
"I need to use your restroom pretty bad."
I want to laugh, but I can't remember how. I turn to my door and he steps out of the way for me to unlock it. My trembling hand pushes open the door to my apartment and I walk inside, then point to the hallway. On the right. I don't look back at him while he walks in that direction. I wait until the bathroom door closes and I fall onto the couch and bury my face in my hands. I hate that he's here. I hate that I let him in without question. I hate that as soon as he walks out of the bathroom, I'm going to have to make him leave. But I just can't do this to myself anymore. I'm still trying to gather myself when the bathroom door opens and he walks back into the living room. I look up at him and can't look away. Something is different. He's different. The smile on his face, the peacefulness in his eyes, the way he carries himself like he's floating. It's only been 2 weeks, but he looks so different. He takes a seat on the couch and doesn't even bother putting space between us. He sits right next to me and leans into me. So I close my eyes and wait for whatever words he's about to say that will hurt me again. That's all he knows how to do. "Tate," he whispers. "I miss you." Whoa. I was absolutely not expecting to hear those three words, but they just became my new favorite words. I and miss and you. "Say it again, Miles."
"I miss you, Tate," he says immediately. "So much. And it's not the first time. I've missed you every single day we weren't together since the moment I met you."
He wraps his arms around my shoulders and pulls me to him. I go. I fall to his chest and grab hold of his shirt, squeezing my eyes shut when I feel his lips press against the top of my head.
"Look at me,"
he says softly, pulling me onto his lap to face him. I do. I look at him. I actually see him this time. There's no guard up. There's no invisible wall blocking me from learning and exploring everything about him. He's allowing me to see him this time. And he's beautiful. So much more beautiful than before. Whatever changed in him, it was huge.
"I want to tell you something," he says. "This is so hard for me to say because you're the first person I've ever wanted to say it to. I'm scared to move. His words are terrifying me, but I nod.
I had a son, he says quietly, looking down at our hands now laced together.
Those three words are delivered with more pain than any three words I've ever heard.
I inhale.
He looks up at me with tears in his eyes, but I remain quiet for him, even though his words just knocked the breath out of me.
He died 6 years ago.
His voice is soft and distant, but it's still his voice.
I can tell those words are some of the hardest he's ever had to say.
It hurts him so much to admit this. I want to tell him to stop. I want to tell him I don't need to hear it if it hurts. I want to wrap my arms around him and rip the sadness from his soul with my bare hands. But instead, I let him finish.
Miles looks back down at our interlocked fingers. I'm not ready to tell you about him yet. I need to do it at my own pace.
I nod and squeeze his hands reassuringly.
I will tell you about him, though, I promise. I also want to tell you about Rachel. I want you to know everything about my past.
I don't even know if he's finished, but I lean forward and press my lips to his. He pulls me against him so tightly and pushes back against my mouth so hard, it's as if he's telling me he's sorry without using words.
Tate,
he whispers against my mouth. I can feel him smiling.
I'm not finished.
He lifts me and adjusts me next to him on the couch. His thumb circles my shoulder as he looks down at his lap, forming whatever words he's needing to say to me.
I was born and raised in a small suburb just outside of San Francisco, he says, bringing his eyes back up to meet mine. I'm an only child. I don't really have any favorite foods because I like almost everything. I wanted to be a pilot for as long as I can remember. My mother passed away from cancer when I was 17. My father has been married for about a year to a woman who works for him. She's nice and they're happy together. I've always kind of wanted a dog, but I've never had one.
I watch him, mesmerized. I watch his eyes as they roam around my face while he talks, while he tells me all about his childhood and his past, and how he met my brother and his relationship with Ian. His hand finds mine, and he covers it as though he's becoming my shield, my armor.
The night I met you, he finally says. The night you found me in the hallway.
His eyes dart toward his lap, unable to hold contact with mine.
My son would have been 6 that day.
I know he said he wants me to listen to him, but right now I just need to hug him. I lean forward and wrap my arms around him, and he lies back on the couch, pulling me on top of him.
It took everything I had to try to convince myself that I wasn't falling for you, Tate. Every single time I was around you, the things I would feel terrified me. I had gone 6 years thinking I had control of my life and my heart and that nothing could ever hurt me again. But when we were together, there were moments I didn't care if I ever hurt again because being with you almost felt worth the potential pain. Every time I began to feel that way, I would just push you farther away out of guilt and fear. I felt like I didn't deserve you. I didn't deserve happiness at all because I'd taken it away from the only two people I had ever loved.
His arms tighten around me when he feels my shoulders shaking from the tears making their way out of my eyes. His lips meet the top of my head, and he inhales a steady breath as he kisses me, long and hard.
I'm sorry it took me so long, he says with a voice full of remorse. But I'll never be able to thank you enough for not giving up on me. You saw something in me that gave you hope in us, and you didn't give up on that. And Tate, that means more to me than anything anyone's ever done.
His hands meet my cheeks, and he lifts me away from his chest so he can see me face to face.
It may be a small piece at a time, but my past is yours now. All of it. Anything you want to know, I want to tell you. but only if you promise me I can also have your future. The tears cascade down my cheeks, and he wipes them away, even though I don't need him to. I don't care that I'm crying, because they aren't sad tears. Not in the least. We kiss for so long my mouth starts to hurt as much as my heart. My heart isn't hurting from pain this time, though. It hurts because it's never felt this full. I trace my fingers across the scar on his jaw, knowing he'll eventually tell me how he got it. I also touch the tender area beneath his eye, relieved that I can finally ask him questions without being scared I'll upset him. What happened to your eye? He laughs and lets his head fall back against the couch. I had to ask Corbin for your address. He gave it to me, but it took a lot of convincing. I immediately lean forward and gently kiss his eye. I can't believe he hit you. Not the first time, he admits. But I'm pretty sure it'll be the last. I think he's finally okay with us being together, after I agreed to a few of his rules. This makes me nervous. What rules? Well, for one, I'm not allowed to break your heart, he says. Second, I'm also not allowed to break your damn heart. And last, I'm not allowed to fucking break your damn heart. I can't contain my laughter because that sounds exactly like something Corbin would say to him. Miles laughs with me, and we take each other in for several quiet moments. I can see everything in his eyes now, every single emotion. Miles, I say with a smile, you're looking at me like you fell in love with me. He shakes his head. I didn't fall in love with you, Tate. I flew. He pulls me back to him and gives me the only part of himself that he's never been able to give me until now. His heart.
Chapter 39, Miles. I stand in the doorway of my bedroom and watch her sleep. She doesn't know it, but I do this every morning she's here with me. She's what starts my day off right. The first time I did this was the morning after I met her. I couldn't remember much from the night before. The only thing I remembered was her. I was on the couch and she was stroking my hair, whispering, telling me to go to sleep. When I woke up in Corbin's apartment the next morning, I couldn't get her out of my head. I thought she had been a dream until I saw her purse in the living room. I peeked inside her bedroom just to see if anyone was in the apartment with me. What I felt the moment I laid eyes on her was something I hadn't felt since the moment I first laid eyes on Rachel. I felt like I was floating. Her skin and her hair and her lips and the way she looked like an angel while I stood there and watched her brought back so many feelings that had become foreign to me over the past 6 years. I had gone so long refusing to allow myself to feel anything for anyone. Not that I could have controlled the feelings I was experiencing toward Tate that day. I couldn't control them if I'd wanted to. I know, because I tried. I tried like hell. But the second she opened her eyes and looked at me, I knew. She was either going to be the death of me, or she was going to be the one who finally brought me back to life. The only problem I had with that was the fact that I didn't want to be brought back to life. I was comfortable, protecting myself from the possibility of experiencing what I had experienced in the past was my only priority. However, there were so many moments when I forgot what my only priority was supposed to be. When I finally caved in and kissed her, that was the point at which everything changed. I wanted so much more after experiencing that kiss with her. I wanted her mouth and her body and her mind, and the only reason I stopped was that I felt myself also wanting her heart. I was good at lying to myself, though, convincing myself that I was strong enough to have her physically and no other way. I didn't want to get hurt again, and I sure as hell didn't want to hurt her. I did anyway, though. I hurt her so much, more than once. Now I plan to spend a lifetime making it up to her. I walk to my bed and sit on the edge of it. She feels the bed shift, and she opens her eyes, but not all the way.
A hint of a smile plays on her lips before she pulls the covers over her head and rolls over. We officially began dating 6 months ago, and that's been plenty long enough for me to realize she's not at all a morning person. I lean forward and kiss the area of blanket covering up her ear. "Wake up, sleepyhead," I whisper. She groans, so I lift the covers up and slide in behind her, wrapping myself around her. Her groan eventually turns into a soft moan. "Tate, you need to get up. We have a plane to catch." That gets her attention. She rolls over cautiously and pulls the covers from over our heads. "What the hell do you mean we have a plane to catch?" I'm grinning, trying to contain my anticipation. "Get up, get dressed, let's go." She's eyeing me suspiciously, which makes total sense considering it's not even 5 o'clock in the morning yet. "I know you know how rare it is for me to have an entire day off, so this better be worth it." I laugh and give her a quick kiss. "That all depends on our ability to be punctual." I stand up and pat the mattress several times with the palms of my hands. "So get up, get up, get up." She laughs and throws the covers off of her completely. She scoots to the edge of the bed and I help her stand up. "It's hard to stay irritated with you when you're this giddy, Miles." We reach the lobby and Cap is waiting at the elevator just as I asked him to. He has her juice in a to-go cup and our breakfast. I love the relationship they have. I was a little worried to reveal to Tate that I had known Cap all my life. When I finally told her, she was irritated with both of us, mostly because she assumed Cap was telling me everything she confessed to him. I assured her Cap wouldn't do that. I know he wouldn't because Cap is one of the few people in this world I trust. He knew just the right things to say to me without appearing as though he were lecturing me or giving me advice. He'd always say just enough to make me think long and hard about my situation with Tate. Luckily, he's one of the few people who grow wiser with age. He knew what he was doing with both of us all along. "Morning, Tate," he says to her, grinning from ear to ear. He holds out his arm for her to take, and she looks back and forth between us. "What's going on?" she asks Cap as he begins to walk her toward the lobby exit. He smiles. "The boy is about to take me on my first ever ride in an airplane. I wanted you to come along, too." She tells him she doesn't believe this is his first time in an airplane. "It's true," he says. "Just 'cause I have the moniker doesn't mean I've ever been on a real plane." The look of appreciation she shoots me over her shoulder is enough to declare this day one of my favorites. And it's not even daylight yet. "You okay back there, Cap?" I say into the headset. He's seated right behind Tate, staring out his window. He gives me a thumbs up, but doesn't take his eyes off the window. The sun hasn't even broken through the clouds yet, and there's not very much to see at this point. We've only been in the plane 10 minutes, but I'm pretty sure he's just as fascinated and mesmerized as I hoped he would be. I return my attention to the controls until I reach optimal altitude, and then I mute Cap's headset. I glance at Tate, and she's staring at me, watching me with an appreciative smile spread across her lips. "Want to know why we're here?" I ask her. She glances over her shoulder at Cap and then looks back at me. "Because he's never done this before." I shake my head, timing it just right. "Remember the day we were driving back from your parents' house after Thanksgiving?" She nods, but her eyes are curious now. "You asked what it was like to experience the sunrise from up here." "It's not something that can be described, Tate." I point out her window. "You just have to experience it for yourself." She immediately turns and looks out her window. Her palms press against the glass, and for 5 minutes straight she doesn't move a muscle. She watches it the entire time, and I don't know how, but I fall even more in love with her in this moment. When the sun has broken through the clouds and the airplane is completely filled with sunlight, she finally turns back to face me. Her eyes are filled with tears, and she doesn't speak a word. She just reaches for my hand and holds it. "Wait here," I tell her. "I want to help Cap out first. A driver is taking him back to the apartment because you and I are going to breakfast after this." She tells Cap goodbye and waits patiently in the plane as I help him down the steps. He reaches into his pockets and hands me the boxes, then flashes me one of his approving smiles. I shove the boxes into the pocket of my jacket and turn back toward the steps. "Hey, boy!" Cap yells right before climbing into the car. I pause and turn around to face him. He looks at the plane behind me. "Thank you," he says, waving his hand down the length of the plane. "For this." I nod, but he disappears inside the vehicle before I can tell him thank you in return. I climb back up the steps and into the plane. She's unbuckling her safety belt, getting prepared to exit the plane, but I slide back into my seat. She smiles at me warmly. "You're incredible, Miles Mickle Archer, and I have to say, you look pretty damn hot flying an airplane. We should do this more often." She gives me a quick peck on the mouth and begins to get up out of her seat. I push her back down. "We're not finished," I say, turning and facing her full on. I take her hands in mine and look down at them, inhaling slowly, preparing to say everything she deserves to hear. "That day you asked me about watching the sunrise," I look in her eyes again. "I need to thank you for that. It was the first moment in more than 6 years I felt like I wanted to love someone again." She blows out a quick breath with her smile and pulls in her bottom lip to try to hide it. I lift a hand to her face and pull her lip out from beneath her teeth with the pressure of my thumb. "I told you not to do that. I love your smile almost as much as I love you." I lean forward to kiss her again, but I keep my eyes open so I can make sure that I'm retrieving the black box first. When I have it in my hand, I stop kissing her and pull away. Her eyes fall to the box and immediately grow wide, moving back and forth between the box and my face. Her hand comes up to her mouth, and she covers her gasp. "Miles," she says, continuing to trade glances between me and the box in my hands. I cut her off. "It's not what you think," I say, immediately opening the box to reveal the key. "It's kind of not what you think," I hesitantly add. Her eyes are wide and hopeful, and I'm relieved by her reaction. I can tell by her smile that she wants this. I pull the key out and flip her hand over, then place it in her palm. She stares at the key for several seconds and looks back up at me. "Tate," I say, looking at her with hope, "will you move in with me?" She looks down at the key one more time, then says two words that bring an immediate smile to my face. "Hell and yes." I lean forward and kiss her. Our legs and arms and mouths become two pieces of a puzzle, fitting together effortlessly. She winds up in my lap, straddling me in the cockpit of the airplane. It's cramped and tight. It's perfect. "I'm not a very good cook, though," she warns. "And you do laundry way better than I do. I just throw all the whites and colors together. And you know I'm not very nice in the morning." She's holding my face, spouting off every warning she can, as if I don't know what I'm getting myself into. "Listen, Tate," I tell her, "I want your mess. I want your clothes on my bedroom floor. I want your toothbrush in my bathroom. I want your shoes in my closet. I want your mediocre leftovers in my fridge." She laughs at that. "Oh, and I almost forgot," I say, pulling the other box from my pocket. I hold it up between us and open it, revealing the ring. "I also want you in my future, forever." Her mouth is open in shock, and she's staring at the ring. She's frozen. I hope she doesn't have any doubts, because I have absolutely none when it comes to wanting to spend the rest of my life with her. I know it's only been 6 months, but when you know, you know. Her silence makes me nervous, so I quickly remove the ring and pick up her hand. "Will you break rule number 2 with me, Tate? Because I really want to marry you." She doesn't even have to say yes. Her tears and her kiss and her laugh say it for her. She pulls back and looks at me with so much love and appreciation it makes my chest hurt. She's absolutely beautiful. Her hope is beautiful. The smile on her face is beautiful. The tears streaming down her cheeks are beautiful. Her love is beautiful. She exhales a soft breath and leans in slowly, gently pressing her lips to mine. Her kiss is filled with tenderness and affection and an unspoken promise that she's mine now, forever. "Miles," she whispers against my mouth, teasing my lips with hers. I've never made love in an airplane before. A smile immediately forms on my lips. It's as if she somehow infiltrated my thoughts. I've never made love to my fiancé before, I say in response. Her hands slowly slide down my neck and shirt until her fingers meet the button on my jeans. Well, I think we need to rectify that, she says, ending her sentence with a kiss. When her mouth meets mine again, it's as if every last piece of my armor disintegrates and every last piece of ice surrounding the glacier that was my heart melts and evaporates. Whoever coined the phrase, I love you to death, obviously never experienced the kind of love Tate and I share. If that were the case, the phrase would be, I love you to life, because that's exactly what Tate did. She loved me back to life. The end. Epilogue. I think back to the day I married her. It was one of the best days of my life. I remember standing next to Ian and Corbin at the end of the aisle. We were waiting for her to walk through the doors when Corbin leaned over and whispered something to me. He said, "You're the only one who could have ever met my standards for her, Miles. I'm happy it's you." I was happy it was me, too. That was more than 2 years ago, and every day since then I've somehow fallen in love with her a little bit more. Or flew, rather. I didn't cry the day I married her, though. Her tears were falling that day, but mine weren't. I was convinced they never would, not in the way I wished they could. It was 8 months ago when we found out we were having a baby. We weren't trying to have a baby, but we also weren't not trying. If it happens, it happens, Tate said. It happened. When we found out, we were both excited. She cried. Her tears were falling. But mine weren't. As excited as I was also scared. I was scared of the fear that comes along with loving someone that much. Scared of everything bad that could happen. I was scared that my memories would take away from the day I became a father again. Well, it just happened. And I'm still scared, terrified. It's a girl, the doctor says. A girl? We just had a baby girl. I just became a father again. Tate just became a mother. Feel something, Miles. Tate looks up at me. I know she can see the fear in my eyes. I also know how much pain she's in right now, but she still somehow manages a smile. Sam, she whispers, saying her name out loud for the first time. Tate insisted we name her Sam in honor of Cap's real name, Samuel. I wouldn't have had it any other way. The nurse walks over to Tate and lays Sam in her arms. Tate begins to cry. My eyes are still dry. I'm still too scared to look away from Tate and down at our daughter. I'm not afraid of what I'll feel when I look at her. I'm afraid of what I won't feel. I'm terrified. My past experiences have ruined any ability I have to feel what every father should feel in this moment. Come here, Tate says, wanting me closer. I sit down next to them on the bed. She hands Sam to me, and my hands are shaking, but I take her anyway. I close my eyes and release a slow breath before finding the courage to open them again. I feel Tate's hand fall gently to my arm. She's beautiful, Miles, she whispers. Look at her. I open my eyes and inhale sharply when I see her. She looks just like he did, except that she has Tate's brown hair. Her eyes are blue. She has my eyes. I feel it. It's all there. Everything I felt the first time I held him in my arms is every single thing I'm feeling now as I look down at her. Believing that I lacked the ability to love someone in this capacity again was the only fear I had left to conquer. One look at Sam, and she just helped me conquer that fear. She's already my hero, and she's only 2 minutes old. She's so beautiful, Tate, I whisper. So beautiful. My voice cracks. My face is covered in tears. Falling, falling, falling. For the first time since the moment I held Clayton in my arms, I'm crying tears of joy. Rachel was right. The pain will always be there. So will the fear. But the pain and fear are no longer my life. They're only moments. Moments that are constantly overshadowed with every minute I spend with Tate. And now every minute I spend with Sam. Me and Tate and Sam. My family. I kiss her on the forehead and then I lean over and kiss Tate for giving me something this beautiful again. Tate lays her head on my arm and we both watch her. Our daughter. I love you so much, Sam. I'm looking down at the perfection we created when it hits me. It's all worth it. It's the beautiful moments like these that make up for the ugly love.
Ugly Love was written by Colleen Hoover and read by Grace Grant and Deacon Lee with Elizabeth Louise. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Louisa Solomon. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Ugly Love is available in print from Atria Books. Also by Colleen Hoover from Simon & Schuster Audio, Finding Cinderella, read by Jason Carpenter, and Losing Hope, read by Kirby Hayborn.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.